And that is the topic, Sergio.
Okay, thank you, Zoltan. So I was going to talk today about what's our basis for thinking that all the perturbative calculations we do have any relevance for collider physics. And I wasn't told what the time of this is. I presume it's scheduled for 1 hour, which actually means 3 hours, right? My plan, however, is to try to shoot for 45 minutes and leave some time for a discussion. And I've got in here some number of comments scattered through the talk. And a lot of those are a bit controversial. They're just my opinion. And people may want to talk about it. So I could anticipate that we can have a nice discussion. But I would propose not to debate the comments until we get to the end. Otherwise, we never get through. So what's the point of this? Cross-sections for hadron colliders are calculated using perturbation theory. The particles that come in and help most of the particles that go out carry strong interactions. And as we know, the strong coupling alpha strong evaluated at a distance scale of 1 Fermi is kind of 1. So what business do we have to do perturbation theory on that? And roughly speaking, the answer is that it's a property of QCD that we can factor the short distance part of the interaction for producing W bosons or IPT jets or whatever, or Higgs bosons. We can factor that out and separate it from the long distance parts. So what I'd like to talk about is why and what's there, and there's sort of a proof of that, but what's maybe lacking in the proof. And I'm reminded that if it's not the case that this is really solid science that backs this up, then we're acting on faith. And it's a faith that's believed in by everybody in this room, so there's a community of people who believe in that faith. And that gave me the idea that we could boost the LHC funding, because I checked the government websites and found that there is extra funding for that sort of thing. So you can conclude after this talk what sort of funding we ought to apply for. Here's the formula. Do we have a pointer? Yeah, oh, this is a good solid pointer, huh? Here's the main factorization formula. Everyone's seen this lots of times. It says a cross-section, and I'm going to just take as an example Julien cross-section, produce muon pairs from proton and antiproton collision. Then you have a distribution of partons in hadron A with a probability distribution function, another one for hadron B, and a hard scattering cross-section. This is what you're supposed to compute. And the corrections to this formula are supposed to be of order m squared and 1 GeV squared over q squared. Q squared is the virtuality of that muon pair. This is the very simplest kind of form. There's lots of other cases where, say, you want to produce a Z boson plus jets or whatever. Then you have strongly interacting particles going in the final state, and you measure something about them. It's not completely inclusive. And in that case, the formula is a little more involved. So you have a sigma hat, a hard scattering cross section that's differential in q squared and y still, but then differential in the momenta of all your partons. And you integrate over the partons. And then you multiply by a function that says what it is you're going to measure. And that's supposed to have corrections of order m squared over q squared also. But this S has to be really special. So if two of the partons become collinear with each other, then the S for n plus 1 partons with two of them collinear should equal the S for just m partons, where you just put the two together. Also, if one of the partons is collinear with beam A, then you should have the same measurement function as without that parton entirely. or collinear with beam B, you should also just be able to take that parton out. So this is, you set up, you say what your measurement function is, but it's, for instance, a jet algorithm, a jet of a certain ET comes out at a certain rapidity, but you have to carefully define what a jet is so that your definition has those properties. So that's the formula. So I've got a few comments. This formula is not a leading log formula. The corrections are supposed to be suppressed not by 1 over some large logarithm, they're supposed to be suppressed by a power of 1 over q squared. The parton distributions that appear there have a separate definition. It's the same thing that applies for all the hard processes. There, I'll show you the definition exactly. Those parton distributions are non-perturbative things. You just can't even think about expanding them in powers of alpha s. However, d sigma hat has an expansion in powers of alpha s. So here's some more comments. That formula is supposed to be true to any order in perturbation theory. Now, you may ask at that point, what does that mean? Because I just told you that some of the ingredients are completely non-perturbative and it doesn't make sense to expand them. So what that means is that your initial hadrons, think of them as described by beta Salpeter wave functions. So there's a proton coming in and three quarks coming out, and that wave function has certain properties that the quarks basically, that the quarks want to come out collinearly. If you try to take them with large transverse momentum, it doesn't work, it's suppressed. So within that context, your three quarks are coming, and then they can radiate all kinds of gluons, but that, think of that as perturbative. And final states are your mu plus, mu minus, and then any kind of quarks and gluons. Expand that to 17th order, or whatever you like, and that's what perturbation theory means, at any order in that kind of graphical expansion. Then what you do is just do everything up to some big order, alpha s to the n, and that formula ought to work within corrections not only 1 over m squared, but of order alpha s to the m plus n plus 1. But n could have been anything there. And I probably ought to be straightforward and tell you that d sigma hat actually probably doesn't have a definition beyond perturbation theory. So its perturbative expansion makes sense. But if you sum perturbation theory, presumably, as in most everything else in QCD, the nth order contribution to sigma hat would be proportional to n factorial. So you have to stop any such series when n times alpha s is of order 1. So that's when the terms stop getting smaller, that's when you should stop adding things up. Unless you have a belief that you know some Borel transform method of adding up the series. So if you stop at order alpha s equals 1 over n, or n equals 1 over alpha s, then there's an ambiguity from the terms you neglected. And those would be, the term you left out is n factorial alpha s to the n. Using a Stirling formula, that's e to the minus n, or e to the minus 1 over alpha s, which is lambda over q squared to some constant. So inherently, even in the definition of the hard scattering cross-section, there's also a power ambiguity. So we're not going to, I wish we could do better than that, but I don't think so. At any rate, we're struggling to get to next to leading order among this group here. That's n equals 3, and this would allow n equals 10. So there's a lot of work still to do. I collected some references just to show you the kind of the history of this a little bit. To my knowledge, the first paper that kind of set this out was Amati, Petronzio, and Veneziano in 1978 about relating hard scattering QCD processes through universality of mass singularities. So that's working back from the hard scattering, and you see then that there's singularities which belong to the parton distributions. I think that's the first paper. There's one by Libby and Sturman, and there's one by Mueller called cut vertices, and you wrote a bunch of papers about cut vertices. It's similar to this stuff. There's a quite important paper by Sturman about how to analyze such things in terms of counting powers for important integration regions. And then a key paper, and one of the authors is here, Keith Ellis is here, stating that, quote, "We prove that for any process which admits a parton model interpretation, the naive parton model can be modified to include the effects of QCD interactions at all orders of perturbation theory." So that was taking this formula. This formula I showed you was already known as kind of a model, but this paper was saying it wasn't a model. Now, this doesn't say anything that's really different from what was in those previous papers, but it says it a whole lot more clearly. Also proves it, but proofs may be a little lacking. For instance, just shortly thereafter, Doyer, Frankel, and Taylor showed that this factorization doesn't work if you go beyond the leading power. So that maybe leaves a little doubt. And also, this proof was lacking a lot in the treatment of the soft gluons that you'll learn about in just a moment. So a little while later, Bodwin, Brodsky, and Lepage published a paper saying that it is shown that initial state interactions violate the QCD factorization predictions for massive lepton pair production in leading twists. That means leading power. So you can imagine that was a little controversial. And I and Collins and Sturman wrote one saying, well, okay, is that right? And it does it factorize? And we said yes, but well, we were hedging our bets there, so sort of. We were concerned about whether the parton distributions that factor out are the same as you get in deeply elastic scattering or something else, because there's a difference between final states and initial states. Okay, after that, there's an important paper here by Lindsay, Ross, and Socrata, which did a real two-loop calculation that had a chance to show that factorization was going to fail, and they added up all the terms, and miraculously, the terms canceled, the bad terms canceled. So that was good. And Collins and Sturman and I wrote a paper about the same time. In fact, if you're interested in the story, these guys were set to give a talk at the 1982 International Conference on High Energy Physics, and I was set to give a talk for this group, and we were set to say the opposite things. Us, that yes, it's got to work because we can prove it. They, that it doesn't work because we calculated it. But just in the last couple of weeks before the conference, they added up all their terms and they canceled. I'm going to talk about this paper and then this one, which added a whole bunch to the proof, which we'd kind of overlooked in that one. Jeff Bodwin wrote a paper at the same time, which is quite a detailed proof of factorization, leaving out some of the stuff that we cover here. You may recall he was on the paper on the other side of this in an earlier slide. And there's also a paper by us on that says that this works for heavy particle production, like for top production, which everybody, of course, believes now, but wasn't believed earlier. Well, you'd think it was settled, but just a couple of years ago, Gossman, Levin, and Moore published something saying they had a specific example showing that this doesn't work. And said, so everything must have been mistaken. And we wrote a paper taking their example and disassembling it and reconstructing it and saying, well, it's actually okay, you just missed something. I also give you a reference to the definition of parton distributions. So that's our lightning historical review. I want to do a exercise so that when I'm waving my hands more vigorously later on, at least there's something that's a little bit concrete here. I want to look at a kind of a, just a sample model integral so you get the idea of what happens. You suppose you have a model for cross-section. Its lowest order is 1. The alpha s is an integral that I wrote here. And then there'd be higher order corrections. And here's the integral. This part represents hadronic part. This part represents hard part. Q is supposed to be big, much bigger than m. M is proton mass. So how could you analyze that? And what you do is what I call the naive accounting for leading regions, which Sturman, that paper I showed you by Sturman a long time ago, tells you how to do. You say here, look at the regions. K could either be small or large, small of order m, so much small, much, well, K much smaller than Q. If K is much smaller than Q, integrate over that region, and this thing turns into Q squared over Q squared. That's 1. So here's the contribution for small K. On the other hand, K could be of order Q squared, Q. In that case, here, if K is much bigger than M, you can neglect the M, so you get 1 over K squared. And then those are the two leading integration regions. Anything else is power suppressed. You've made approximations in those regions, but the approximation corrections are power suppressed, so you ought to get order M squared over Q squared. Now you put that back together, or just write the whole cross-section as 1 plus alpha S in the small K squared part, times 1 plus alpha s in the large k squared part. Then there's a plus order alpha s squared, of course, because I only did this to lowest order. And plus order m squared over q squared, because I made approximations. And that's the analog of the whole business. That's part-time distribution function. That's this one. Only this is a really, really simple model for a part-time distribution function. And sigma hat, that's this one. Now, you may say, whoa, that's really crude. What do you mean? K squared much less than Q squared, K squared about Q squared. I mean, that's a little vague, right? Here's a better way. I take the same integral, I put in something like dimensional regularization, but in this case, it's not needed because it's a conversion integral. So epsilon is supposed to go to 0 here. And I first approximate that second term by just 1. And then I take the 1 that I put in here and just subtract it from the second term. So I've just rewritten exactly what I had. And then in this second integral, I recognize that since I've subtracted the small k squared behavior of the hard part, that difference has a factor of k squared in it. So small k squared is not important in this second piece. So I could approximate the second piece by replacing k squared plus m squared by just k squared, making an order m squared over q squared error. So that's what I can do. This first integral now is divergence, so I subtract 1 over epsilon. That cures its divergence. And I add 1 over epsilon to the second term. The original wasn't divergent, right? So it's you add and subtract the same 1 over epsilon. And then this is the first order piece of the model parton distribution. And this is the first order piece of the model sigma hat. But now I've used dimensional regularization, so to speak, and done it quite precisely, whereas the other one was pretty vague. That's a subtraction scheme, and it defines my hard part with a nice subtraction on it so that the soft behavior of the hard part vanishes. So we wish there was a subtraction scheme for doing this factorization business, and there isn't. The proof works more like the first naive method, where it's pretty vague. And part of the message of this is somebody ought to do better. Let me now show you the very simplest graph for Drouillard production. So here's my beta Salpeter wave functions. This is zero order in perturbation theory. Besides the beta Salpeter wave functions, there's nothing. The quarks collide, they make a virtual photon, which will decay into the muon pairs, but I didn't draw it. what is this exactly? Well, there's integrals and there's a loop integral here, right? So I just wrote my loop momenta, and I'm integrating over the transverse momentum of this photon. So I've got two transverse momentum integrals, and then one plus integral and one minus integral. Plus means E plus PZ. So I've just chosen good variables for writing my loop integration. And there's a hard part, which is really trivial, and a Dirac trace, and some function phi A that's this bottom part, or the top part, and a function phi B that's the bottom part. So given that those wave functions force transverse momenta to be of order m squared, you can make some approximations. So these transverse momenta both have got to be smaller than q squared. And then this is moving fast. In the plus direction, its minus momentum is really small. So ka minus has got to be much less than q minus. And this is moving fast in the minus direction, so its plus momentum of that has to be small. So ka plus is much less than q plus. So now you just go that. Neglect kb plus there. Neglect ka minus there. In here, neglect the transverse momentum compared to q plus q minus. It's kinematic approximations. There's also some approximation on the Dirac structure. And after that, you're done. It's really trivial. Then the integral over this is the parton distribution function for the bottom. This one's for the A. This is the parton distribution for the top. The Dirac structure goes away. And you have the usual formula for dry end process. So at lowest order, it's kinematic. It's really simple. But the real world is not so simple. Analysis in a naive style, I must say, of leading integration regions gives you the picture I drew. So now there's stuff collinear to the A particle. There's stuff collinear to the B particle. Everything in blue is collinear to one or the other. And there's hard particles, that's here, because you could emit some hard gluons that have big transverse momenta, and several hard gluons for that matter. And those things go in the final state, and we integrate over all that. So lots of hard stuff. And then there's a bunch of soft gluons. That means things that have momentum components that all go to zero in the limit of, compared to q squared. Okay, that's the general situation. The soft, I might add, actually composes some different kinds of integration regions. There's something you'd really like to call soft where all the components are roughly the same size, and there's some other cases where the gluon momenta have plus components and minus components that are much smaller than the transverse components. That goes under the name of the Glauber region. That's a region that gives a whole bunch of trouble, because various approximations that you'd like to make don't work in the Glauber region. Okay, how about those collinear gluons? I drew them, they were coming in. Remember, they used to come into this red part. That's really bad. Why is it really bad? Because the whole formula is about two partons have a collision and make the hard stuff. Not three, not four, five, two. There is double parton scattering. It's a real effect, but it's suppressed by power. It's even been observed at Fermilab. So in the original picture, I had a whole bunch of particles coming in to make the hard process. That doesn't agree with the formula. On the other hand, when you look at how that happens, the gluons that were doing it have polarization epsilon proportional to their momenta in the limit. And whenever you have a vector particle whose polarization is proportional to its momentum in a gauge theory, there's tricks to take care of it. It's a good approximation then to say that this gluon that was coming and hitting everything else winds up just hitting what's called an Eichenholz line, which has Feynman rules. And the Feynman rules is for one of those little propagators there. It's I over k dot u, where u is a light-like vector, plus I epsilon. And for the vertex there, or here there's two vertices, That's minus IG color matrix U. For the top part where the hadron was going in the plus direction, U points in the minus direction. For the bottom part where the hadron was going in the minus direction, U points in the top, in the plus direction. With that understanding of the meaning of this, it's a good approximation for those collinear gluons to end up looking like this. And then they just sort of one combined thing that's going in to make the hard interaction. Of course, there's all those soft guys. We're going to have to deal with that. But I should tell you about the proton distribution functions. So we're factoring one thing from another, and what we ought to know is what we're factoring in and what we're factoring out. Here's the definition of a proton distribution function, this kind of standard one called MS bar definition. And what it is a matrix element in a proton state averaged over spin. And what you do is destroy a quark. This is a quark operator. And Fourier transforms so that what you destroy has momentum xp plus. So it's finding a quark with momentum xp plus in the proton. And here's the operator that recreates it. There's wants to be a gamma plus gamma matrix in there. And the only subtle thing is there's an iconal operator there that's a path ordered exponential of a line integral from the y minus here out to infinity of the plus component of the gluon field. That formula has a simple interpretation as just the number operator in null plane field theory. And in that interpretation, A plus, you choose a gauge, A plus equals zero, so this thing isn't there. But if you add back this in, if you add this back in, that makes a gauge invariant definition. Your only problem is that that operator product is divergent because this operator and that operator are at the same transverse momentum, transverse position. So we start just any diagram is likely to diverge. And the operator needs renormalization. So there's a standard way to renormalize operators, and you do it, and to subtract the poles. The only thing is, since this is the bilocal operator, the subtraction things are like kernels. So I got some little comments about that. You have to renormalize this. That means you have to put in a scale, mu, if you do it in a dimensional way, which is the definition. And then there's a dependence on mu. That's the renormalization group equation. And the renormalization group equation for this is what's called the Duchsitzer, Griebov, Lipitov, Altarelli, Parisi equation, which was originally arrived at a different way. And I mention again that this thing does not have a perturbative expansion. And I also mention that sometimes, particularly in textbooks, you read about how to do calculations and you read that you start with some kind of a bare parton distribution, and then you hit some divergences and you subtract something from the bare parton distribution, and that makes a Dress parton distribution. Well, in that case, this is the Dress parton distribution, but there isn't a bare parton distribution. I've never seen a good explanation of what the definition of the bare parton distribution is. These things are used in calculations. If you do a next to leading order or next to next to leading order calculation of the sigma hat, then your parton distributions that you're using, which of course are not the exact ones, they're the approximate ones, had better obey the Altarelli-Parisi equation to some requisite order. Otherwise, the independence of the scale won't work correctly in your calculation. And what order is it for a next to leading order calculation, you're doing things at two loops, so you need the Altarelli Parisi occurrence, the two loops. And that is usually called next to leading order with respect to parton distributions. So it's a little bit confusing. People have now begun, well, mostly in the past, I should say, parton distributions are fitted to data using calculations that are done to next leading order. Nobody would dare use a leading order calculation. It's just not accurate enough. But next leading order is pretty good. And there just started to be some parton distributions that have, at least in part, data fitted to theory which has next to next to leading order. And I have rather frequently heard comments that you're not allowed to use data fitted to theory that's only next to leading order if you want parton distributions that are going to be used in a next to next to leading order calculation. And I regard the concept of throwing away data as sort of silly. And I remind you that alpha s of mz, similar to the parton distributions, is a non-perturbative quantity. I mean, it is the coupling. You can't expand it in powers of the coupling. And it is fit to experiment. We know the value, 0.118, with errors, which are also estimated. And some of the experiments used to fit alpha s are, the theory is at next to next to leading order, and for some of the experiments, it only at next to leading order. And nobody worries about that. You just use all the data you can, put in data where the theory isn't so good, you put in bigger errors. And then you do an error analysis. So that's my comment, but at the end we may want to have some discussion of that. Okay, what are the diagrams? If I just take that definition that I showed you, here's what a parton distribution looks like. The diagrammatic expansion for that iconal line is got the same rules that I just showed you. It's these little double, represented by these double lines. So it's a gluon operator. The gluon operator absorbs gluons. So there I drew some gluons getting absorbed. The fact it goes into the final state is just a kind of a sign that you're supposed to do a loop integral. So that parton distribution has this picture. And now I remind you about this picture. And you can see they're beginning to look the same. So the purpose in life, if you like, of the iconal lines in the parton distribution definition is to mimic the ones, the iconal lines that come in when you start to factor. And I may point out even some a little bit deeper. When you actually measure something, so let's think of deeply inelastic scattering, just replace the bottom part of this photon comes in. Then there's a quark, it gets struck, it goes out, goes into the final state in deeply inelastic scattering. The iconal line mimics the effect of that struck quark going into the final state. That struck quark carries color. And no matter what interaction you're going to be talking about, there's always the color coming in and disappears. So the remaining color is, you know, the opposite color going into the final state. So there it is. And that's what the iconal line is for in the definition, and that's why then you get the same thing when you start to factor. Okay. Soft gluon exchanges. Well, this is where the real problem is, and here's where I'm not going to have a real technical explanation because it would take several hours and I'm not actually even prepared to do it. But I can give you some idea. There's all these soft gluons, and I drew them kind of near the final state, but they can be, all that stuff can be happening in the initial state. So they happen both initial and final states. And what you're worried about kind of is the following, that from down here, from a spectator, a real soft gluon gets emitted and falls over there, you know, inside of here, so you didn't really see it, and it hits the active quark that's going to annihilate. And a whole bunch of those can happen, and they just rotate the color of the active quark. Really softly, don't affect any of its momentum, just rotate its color. But then, this quark was used to be a blue, and this used to be anti-blue, and they were going to annihilate, but this turns into red, and now they can't annihilate. So this soft color exchange can change the cross-section. And soft color exchanges happen over long distances, so there's no hope of doing it in perturbation theory, so you're lost. There's nothing to do. That's the idea of this Bodwin, Brodsky, and Lepage paper. Well, what you'd like to do is use some soft gluon approximations. There's when a soft gluon with all momentum components are equal hits a fast line, it's a good approximation to treat it with this Eichenholz approximation. And that can really help in the analysis. But just for the kind of case I mentioned to you, the soft gluons have Q plus, Q minus. It's too small. It's trapped in this Glauber region because there's pinches on the Q plus, Q minus integrals that keep you from deforming the contour to get away from that. So you can't use the approximations and you're just sort of stuck. But in the end, after a lot of analysis, they all go away. So you can just erase this green stuff and you get that stuff, and that's essentially the factorized form. So that part is pretty technical, and I think the best thing is to tell you the kind of ingredients in it. Unitarity, you sum over all final states, and it's important you sum over all final states consistent with making the W boson. Causality gets in here. It's technically, it comes in by using, looking at integration contours and seeing where the poles are. So you know in energy space, a pole in the upper half plane means nothing was happening for a negative time and so forth. That's how you do it. So it's where poles are in complex Q plus Q minus planes that reflects causality. And you've got to look at both in Q plus Q minus integrals and figure out where the poles are. And see that it, well, make some arguments. Gauge invariants, because all the soft gluon approximations that allowed this to happen, that's based on gauge invariants. Also, you use the fact that what's happening here is some slightly off-shell partons come in from a color singlet state. And then in the end, they go to a final state there. You just treat those as on-shell massless partons. But they came in from a color singlet state and, you know, never exactly on-shell. And then you sum over all the final states. Now, what's sort of the picture? Why is that important? Partons can always have collisions. Two spectators can collide. So I'll just give you kind of an intuitive feel, because it's too hard to do the technical arguments. But intuitively, all those spectator partons coming in that collide, that's going to happen. But it happens at the same time or after the basic hard interaction that made the W boson. Because these are pancakes coming in. They're Lorentz contracted. So pancakes come in. Well, okay, those other ones collide, but they are not causally connected to the main collision. The only thing that kind of goes wrong with that is there's soft color fields. And the soft color fields are there, and they spread out over space-time. You know, they're always there. So a proton, maybe a fast-moving proton is like a pancake, but it's soft color fields all over the place. The soft color field doesn't Lorentz contract, as you may have learned there's a piece of Jackson's electrodynamics book that's about that. However, just in the case where you're way off here and here's your pancake and your field's way out there, that field's looking like a gauge field. That is, its polarization is proportional to its momentum. And just those you can simplify. And just for that very long distance piece, what does it look like? For the very, very longest distance piece, two color singlets are coming in. They don't really have anything. Then they collide, and two color triplet and anti-triplet are going out. And that's what has the big field, but it's all a final state interaction, so it goes away by summing over everything, by unitarity. that is pretty hand-waving. But in the end, that's what's happening. So I got some comments about all of that. As I was just explaining, that proof is really using the fact that the initial hadrons are color singlets and they're bound states. On the other hand, when you really do a calculation, the way to do it is do a calculation of the cross-section you're interested in for incoming quarks and gluons on shell with dimensional regularization all over the place. That's a divergent cross-section. However, you can calculate easily what is the parton distributions, the distributions of quarks and gluons in a quark and gluon. It's divergence, 1 over epsilon times Walter Raleigh-Parisi kernel. And you can do it to next order too. So what you do is you factor out those parton distributions, which you just calculated perturbatively, and leave the sigma hat and divide by the parton distributions, and that's your sigma hat. But that requires factorization to work for incoming on-shell quarks and gluons, and this proof doesn't cover that case. So that's too bad, and it would be nice to have a proof that did cover the case that really helps for calculations. That was point two. Point three is you really need a proof that has a full subtraction method. So you may be familiar with the proofs of renormalization, that renormalization works. And there's forests and trees and stuff. That's a subtraction method. And you can really see everywhere that once you've applied the renormalization procedure, that there are no ultraviolet divergences left. Because everywhere there's a chance to be one, there's some little box that tells you subtracted, and that divergence went away. So you'd like that same kind of argument here, and it doesn't exist. Nobody has done it.
What stopped? I mean, people tried.
No. People got tired of it. Everyone's doing string theory. Also, there's no detailed proof I know of for hadron collisions with a non-trivial measurement function, except for some early proofs with just electron-positron annihilation. And that would be nice. I think the perturbative part of that is not so awful. We just imagine everything's quarks and gluons, because everything's final state interactions and you can use unitarity. However, what you'd really like, I think, is an analysis with proper bound state hadrons going out. And what you have to address is, what you really do is you take the same measurement function that you use from experiment, and the experiments have pions coming out, right? So you'd like to have pion beta Salpeter wave functions going out, and then show, don't just guess, but show that having beta Salpeter wave functions for all the outgoing particles gives you the same answer with power corrections as you get from using just quarks and gluons going out with the same measurement functions. Nobody's done that. So there's my wish list. I thought I'd end up by just showing you a little example. Not a calculational example, it's a thought example. Consider diffractive deeply elastic scattering. Electron plus proton goes to electron plus X plus a proton. So what you do is you have the proton, it's at Hera. You hit it with this very virtual photon, and then you've got a detector down there at the end, which detects the proton again, and you find it's lost 5% of its energy and had a 300 MeV transverse momentum kick. And you measure the transverse momentum kick, or the scattering, invariant scattering momentum transfer T, and the energy fraction loss is called XP, and you can just measure a diffractive cross-section DF2 DXP DT. And then the factorization for that works with diffractive parton distributions, which are intuitively telling you what's the probability that you steal a quark from a proton and nevertheless the proton remains intact. And so these things have been measured. They're determined by comparing to the experiments at Hera. And there's a proof of the factorization by Collins.
So this is the so-called Pomeran.
Yeah, so you can call these the distribution of the Pomeran in a proton times the distribution of quarks in a Pomeran. But that's a terrible language. You don't use that language. But that's what people say. It just suggests that a Pomeran is like a baseball. And a proton sitting there and tosses up this baseball and it floats out there, it's just wrong. That picture's wrong. In any case, this...
You have a better picture?
Yeah, Pomeran's a T-channel thing. So what happens is, I'll draw it on the board for you. But let's go to the last slide here. You might imagine that this should also work then for hadron-hadron scattering. But it can't happen for hadron-hadron scattering. Technically, in the proof is all wrong because you had to sum over everything to make the proof work in hadron-hadron scattering. And you're not allowed to sum over everything because there's a restriction that you have to recover a proton in the final state. So, and here's why physically it can't work. Here's a proton hitting an antiproton. It happens that those two quarks are going to hit and make a Z boson. That's my hard process. So they do, and then the final state I'm looking for is, well, the antiproton got broken up into a whole bunch of stuff, and there's a few extra partons left around, and then I reconstructed a proton. It just went off down the beam pipe with a little less energy. So that can happen with a sort of small probability, but not so small, in deep inelastic scattering. But you would just imagine that it can't possibly happen because of spectator interactions, just the ones you were worried about before, in proton-proton collisions. So these guys were coming in, and this quark is very likely to hit that one and get bounced off to the side. And it's got to be much, much more difficult in a proton-proton case compared to deeply inelastic scattering to get the proton back. That's much more likely. So you expect from the organization of the proof that this factorization is not going to work for diffractive proton-proton goes to Z. And in fact, it doesn't. And it's been measured at Fermilab, and it's off by like a factor of 10. Okay, that's what I had to say, and we have some time left, like 10 minutes anyway, so we could do some discussion, I think. You'd like to know what Pomeran really looks like? Can I... oh dear, we don't have a separate board here, do we? Should we raise that? I don't know. Do we need any more of the pictures? How do we turn the projector off? Here's a space-time picture of deeply inelastic scattering with the proton getting made again in the final state. This is the final state here. And that's a way it can happen. But if you look at what's leading order of in momentum space, for things to happen, it's this is diffractive scattering. So the proton didn't emit something that's like a bound state. That would look like this, which then gets hit. It sort of dissolves in the middle part of this, starts dissolving long ago. It gets hit in the middle, but fortunately, so there's some fragments going in the right direction, and then as time goes on in the far future, it gets put back together again. So that's the picture that's suggested by perturbation theory.
I could say it's a ladder.
It emits a ladder, but the ladder's in the T-channel.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the ladder's not going this way. That's the difference. It's a space-time picture of what's happening. So that one, but not... not anything like that.
So the polar image is not a parton, really?
Yeah, it's not like a parton. Or it's not... you can think of a proton as having a cloud of pions around it, and you could hit one of the pions. That's not a dumb picture. But to think of a proton as having a cloud of Pomerons around it is not really right.
So even comment, probably for good reasons, about the use of factorization where it's not more. So, I mean, you know, there are applications in cases where there are no proofs, or is that because you know that it's not true? Or
oh, there's mostly, oh, for exclusive processes, I think it's probably all right, but that's a different kind of factorization. But there's lots of cases where, say, you've measured things in the final state for which there's no detailed proof. So the only case that's got lots of papers and long papers about it is the Troyen process. Higgs production, no.
Or jet production.
Jet production, there's no proofs. But everybody expects that it's still, it's okay. Nobody's willing to do the proof. Yeah?
I mean, you mentioned that factorization theorems, basically, they say, okay, it works, but it's non-constructive. It means that
yes.
You know the way how you work, say, a two loop, I'll make the adequate subtractions. Or here are some people in the loop who would be very interested in that. Now, you said at the time people thought about this. Are there some hidden information which are somewhere hidden in some drawer which people couldn't read today?
Not in my drawer. I don't know. People, we would, I mean, I've talked with Collins about it. Right.
And there are some ideas which are not.
Yeah, so it would be nice to have a construction so that this sigma hat thing comes out as here is a basic thing and then minus its subtraction and the subtractions are all nested. And there is now a kind of a technology that's emerging, which I don't know a whole lot about soft collinear effective theory, which tries to build that into that kind of language into the action, and then expands with different kinds of operators. So that might be a technology which would enable you to do a constructive proof. It is not, however, a constructive proof in itself. It's just something that might help. But the problem is that there's different kinds. There's soft to A, soft collinear to A, collinear to B divergences in the limit as M goes to zero, and you're only used to doing one divergence at a time, and no one's quite figured out how to do it. Not to mention that within the soft region, there's the Glauber region, which eventually you can get rid of, but only after a whole bunch of analysis. So. Just nobody's seen how to arrange that all. And maybe this new approach would be helpful. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the way you generally describe bound states. You suppose that then the beta Salpeter wave function has properties that only collinear things come out of it. That it's suppressed to get a gluon coming out that's got a large transverse momentum. So if I've got a proton here, here's a quark coming out. I can get a high transverse momentum quark out of a proton, but it's always a graph like that. And this gluon emitted here is not contained in the beta Salpeter wave function. This has to go in the final state. The beta Salpeter wave function exchange has that, but that doesn't give the thing a big transverse momentum. If it did, if this QT were big, that it would have to flow through the beta salt Peter wave function. So it's at least self-consistent to say that the beta salt Peter wave function restricts transverse momentum. The usual treatment for bound states in field theory uses just the minimal number of partons that has the right quantum number, so that would be 3 quarks. And that's the simplest thing you could use in this kind of an analysis. So I don't know if it would help to, you could. Yeah, that's the way it comes from. Mm-hmm, right. Yeah, that's precisely it. So you have an operator phi that's an interpolating field for a proton, and it's psi, psi, psi. Like that. It's the simplest one you can do. And then that obeys a certain equation, which is the beta Salpeter equation. So it at least allows you to get seemingly self-consistently bound states into the game, where there's enough interactions to keep them bound.
Even though we have absolutely positive, that's not how you get to the game. It's not going to be a solution.
What's not going to be a solution to the betas?
We're not going to find the nucleon, indeed, by, you know.
I don't think it's a practical way to find the nucleon mass.
It's not even a correct one. Because all it does is some perturbation theory.
Yeah, and then it's in terms of the beta Salpeter kernel, which you don't know, right? So you presumably it's right if you had the exact beta Salpeter kernel. Why not?
Because if you think about how it's derived perturbative.
Yeah, but it's summed perturbation theory. If that kernel, I mean.
Yeah, but there's no reason to believe that the equation is
correct.
Think about the derivation.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
You can put in a blob and say, okay, in that blob there's non-determinate stuff, but
well, it works order by order, you know, in perturbation theory, but
yeah. It isn't going to generate.
Well, you don't know that it isn't going to work, but you can't prove that it does work. So that's a fair statement. In any case, it's a completely impractical method because the kernel itself is a non-perturbative thing. So to say that the function obeys an equation it's a non-perturbative function with a non-perturbative kernel, I mean, what good does that do you? It's not a practical thing. It's just a way to think of what you're doing when you're proving this factorization. Right, yeah. Oh, yes, so let me emphasize this, when you really do a calculation, you calculate sigma with incoming quarks, say. And that's parton distribution for a quark in a quark, or for anything in a quark, and parton distribution for anything else in another quark, convoluted with sigma hat. And now everything's perturbative. This is all, they're all divergent, but they're perturbative. And so sigma hat is sigma divided by FF. That's the way you really do a calculation. Only, of course, expand this out in perturbation theory then. And you know what these are, you know what that is, because you calculated it, and that's the answer. And this provides you with, when you expand it in perturbation theory, it provides you with a subtraction onto sigma, which removes the infrared divergences that came up in your calculation. So, I'm not, this is not a matter of so much calculations, but of showing that this formula is, well, at least to show that this formula is true with colored things in the initial state. That hasn't been shown. And I think in any case it would be nice that your hard scattering cross-section sense representation, say, like this, would you would draw, say, it's this minus this, where this was a soft thing, so it has an approximation like that, minus this, where it's in some kind of collinear approximation, so I'll just write a C there, plus the same thing with collinear, let's say, with soft and collinear at the same time, so I don't double subtract those things. So the whole counterterm structure in a nested way, that formula kind of provides it for you in the end, all put together, but it doesn't divide it into soft, collinear, and whatever. And if you had really something like this, you could have a much stronger proof that the whole thing is right. But you could tell us all, maybe.
Don't make a
tiny discussion. I presume that was something interesting, but I didn't hear it.
Now I have two questions. Because you started saying that this Parton formula has never been proven. So that suggests that you believe in the Hadronic factorization formula, but not the Parton one.
No, I think the Partonic one is true, but I just haven't proved it. Or I don't know if anybody has proved it. Yeah, so, well, I can make up a model with some specific wave functions and really do a calculation which my incoming hadrons are represented by wave functions and they're colorless, and calculate that all exactly, and then factor out. That would be completely awkward, of course, but in principle you could do that. So the more the question is, if you did that and factored out the sigma hat, is it the same sigma hat? Is it? And since the sigma hat by construction has got all of the soft stuff removed from it, it better be the same one. But I still would feel more comfortable if somebody analyzed this other problem. Mm-hmm, right.
Yeah. It's also the interplay with measurement. What I would like to have is a way of getting counter terms without having to make a specific reference to a measurement.
We cannot say that.
at one loop, it works very well. It's basically what's written out there on the blackboard. If you subtract the collinear ones, subtract the soft ones, and add back in the collinear soft ones, which you have oversubtracted. And this is all there is. There are different implementations to it. There was first Ellis Ross Perano doing it basically this way, then later on things like the dipole or base slicing, which also did the same thing. And what people are now looking for is the formula like the one which data is written on the backboard for two loop calculations.
Yeah, one loop, it's all works. Yeah, but you don't know exactly what it is. And I might mention, people mentioned exclusive processes. I thought you were actually talking about something different. So what we're talking about here is partially inclusive with a measurement function, with this infrared safe measurement function. There's another technology in which you say do pion-pion scattering at large T. Exclusive, completely exclusive. And there's a hard scattering thing, and then there's pion, it's an analog of distribution functions, only they're amplitudes, so they're called distribution amplitudes, which factor out from the hard scattering. And that's an existing technology. It's not so used because people are less interested. The pion-pion scattering at T equals, or say proton-proton, you don't even have pion beam. So proton-proton scattering for T equals 20 GeV. It doesn't exist because it's too rare, you can't see it. But there are formulas for that, and it's not on as solid a basis, I think, as the more inclusive kind where you're dealing with cross sections.
What is the status of the power law?
There's been some controversy over the years, actually, because there's different pictures of it.
Where?
I think the status is it's a little died down. That's all okay? Oh, he did analyze that, yeah, because there was...
What's the formula? I know what power is. The question is, what are the laws?
I don't remember, but George Sherman did write something nice about that.
Yeah, I remember that too. So nothing has happened.
Well, it's because it's not of all that great experimental interest, otherwise it'd be a lot more.
It's of interest to say to people who are trying to construct string theories of hadrons, where there's power law. I mean, in many ways, the simplest thing you might get out of the string theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from that point of view.
Our properties of QCDs.
Well, I guess,
if you really
I don't remember what Sturman's answer is.
Thing you might want to do, calculating elastic four-point functions, that's what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not uninteresting, even if you're hard to measure.
Okay, yeah, I'll take the point. That's a good point.
These things tend to work.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So the kind of more inclusive kind where there's just a measurement function, I think is not too much harder than without a measurement function where it's completely inclusive. Because the measurement function's matched at just the place where two partons become collinear. So eventually you can just replace the measurement functions by one. At least that would be the strategy.
As long as the measurement functions there must be some criteria.
They should be smooth functions of the arguments, so K1 and K2. And when K1 and K2 become collinear, then the measurement function for those two should be the same as the measurement function for the one. And that says...
measurement functions are satisfied with
this? Yes, they do. And you may know that in the early 80s, there was a period of confusion. People at Petra did experiments. They tried to measure alpha S, and they measured this and that about the final state of electron-positron annihilation. And sometimes this was an infrared-safe observable, and sometimes that was a non-infrared-safe observable. And then they compared, and they got graphs Alpha S just with air bars, and well, they got graphs like that. And that wasn't so good, huh? And now it's understood that really you just should throw out all those things that weren't infrared safe, and you should use next leading order at least calculations. Okay, I might suggest everyone gets a break.
Actually, the diffractive scattering, the interesting example that is not granted the factorization in the
common. Yeah, so that's a case where, I mean, not only it's not proved, it's more or less, it's proved that it doesn't work on theoretical grounds.
Sorry, not this one.
No, diffractive hadron.
Deep
inelastic, yes, because there's no other partons in the initial state. Proton-proton goes to Z boson or something like that. It should not work because there are partons in the initial state and you're not inclusive.
But this has been proved.
For deep inelastic scattering, yes. Diffractive deep inelastic scattering. Right. Yeah, it depends on what process you're actually looking at, W production or jets or whatever, but there's big factors in every case.
In other words, my application of the factorization theorem for modern providers is going to be an acceptable result for the data.
Where is this going to work?
Yeah, for the data.
For deep elastic scattering?
The information you move to the modern provider, and that prediction is.
Okay, I understand. But you can test.
Yeah, that one can actually already been tested. So if nobody has any more questions, then maybe the same data that showed the last.